Well, friends, this text that we're going to be looking at this morning really is quite the contrast from almost all the other texts that we've been studying, or the other chapters. There is no opposition here to God. There's no enemy attacking. There's no plague to be mentioned. There's no human suffering. There's no murmuring. There's no sin that is mentioned. There's no great theological doctrine being questioned here. It seems very anticlimactic. So what is there to talk about in these first 12 verses? Will this be a short sermon this morning? Okay. Ian is shaking his head. He's right. Well, let me start by pointing out that in these 12 verses, that what we read about is a family reunion of sorts. We read that Zipporah and the two children are coming out to meet Moses. Now, that's news, because they left Midian together to go to Egypt, and now we're told that, in fact, they were not together. So it seems that at some point there was a change of plans. And there's all kinds of speculation. Some speculate that they had a falling out as husband and wife, even possibly a divorce had taken place. Others think she just stormed out of his life and went back to dad's home. Some think that maybe Moses felt it was too unsafe for his wife and the children to be involved in what was happening in Egypt, and so he lovingly sent them back. Or perhaps Moses' calling was just 24/7. He was away all the time, and maybe she decided that it was time to go back. Actually, there's a line in the movie, The Ten Commandments, where Zipporah meets Nefertiti, and she says to Nefertiti, she says, "You lost him when he went to seek his God. I lost him when he found his God." You know, there's no question that sometimes when God calls a particular person into ministry, I think of Billy Graham, for example, you know, always on the move. Well, the wife and the family, they have huge sacrifices to make for the sake of the gospel. And sometimes it's not easy, not at all easy. In any case, this chapter reveals that, you know, after a time of separation, and we don't know how long it was and when it took place, but now they were reunited as husband and wife. And we also read in verses 3 and 4 of his reunion with his two sons. By the way, this is the first time that we are introduced to the second son, Eliezer. It's the only time that we read about him. And notice that, we're told both children had very significant names. Gershom's name meant "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land," and Eliezer's name means "the God of my father was my help." So clearly, Moses gave his children these names to tell basically his story, both the good and the bad. In fact, you may recall that when we were studying the life of Joseph, that we read something very similar. In Genesis 41, 51 to 52, we read that Joseph called the firstborn son Manasseh, which signified, "God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house." And then the name of his second child, Ephraim, signified, "For God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction." Now, we don't usually think of telling our story through the names of our children, but clearly the Israelites did. You know, for many of us, we just want to make sure that the first and last name, like, just are, you know, they flow smoothly kind of thing. But here you see how, you know, Moses and Joseph, they wanted the names of their children to bear witness to God's providence in their life. Now, I notice that people today have their own way of telling their story. And I recall being on a city bus, and I sat next to a guy who had tattoos all over his arms. And I asked him, I said, do your tattoos have any significance? Well, he was very thrilled that I had asked him the question, and so he started telling me. He said, oh, this is when my parents kicked me out of the house. And these three up here I got when I was doing time in prison. And then he showed me some of his other arms and, just told me again of all kinds of things that he went through. And then to my surprise, and we were sitting right in the front of the bus, he lifts up his shirt and he continues to tell me, he says, this is when I met my wife and we fell in love. And this is, you know, the next two or three were all about my daughter. And then he had another one right close to his stomach, which this is where, you know, when his sister committed suicide. And so he ran out, and then he said, okay, you know, I have to get off the next stop. And I'm like, oh, thank God for that. I mean, I was thinking he might pull down his pants and continue his story. But, you know, that's where some people, they love to tell their stories through tattoos. In fact, I met with somebody this past week, and I was in her office. And she had a tattoo that said, I'm still here. And so again, you know, it was only one tattoo, so I could risk it this time. But I said, so, you know, what do those words mean to you? And she said that this was a time when I was battling mental illness, and I almost committed suicide. And I wrote this down of how, you know, I'm still here. So that's how modern people tell their story through tattoos. By the way, don't think I'm promoting tattoos or discouraging tattoos, but if you're going to get one, put John 3:16 on your eyelids. It'll be a great way for you to have a conversation with other people. So we're very grateful, you know, to have this information about Moses' reunion with his wife and with his children. But as we really, you know, pay attention to the content of these verses, it's clear that that's not the focus of this chapter. The spotlight is on Jethro. And one clue, really, that it's on Jethro is that reference to father-in-law in this chapter is used 13 times. 13 times it's mentioned father-in-law, father-in-law, father-in-law. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it's clear, or the reason for it, but it's clear that, you know, that he's the main character that we're to be paying attention to. So I want to follow the lead of Scripture and focus on his reunion with his father-in-law, and especially their conversation with each other, and then what ended up happening as a result of that conversation. It was a conversation that made a difference, a huge difference. But first, I want us to just pay attention to Moses' character. Actually, let me go back a little bit. Let me just say, I want you to imagine that Jethro was having an interview, or he was being interviewed and was being asked the question, how do you know Moses? Well, he would say, well, I took him in when he had no home, he had no people, he was on the run, he had no purpose in his life, and he married my daughter, he stayed with me for 40 years. And what did he do when he was with you? Well, he was the shepherd of my flock. And then suddenly, out of the blue, one day he came to me and he said he was going back to Egypt to see whether his family was still alive. And he took my daughter and the children with him, and I said, go in peace. And that was the last that I spoke to him. And since then, I've heard stories of, you know, maybe people who were traveling, incredible stories about what had happened in Egypt. And And then when my daughter came home, she filled in more of the blanks. And but when I last saw Moses, he was just the shepherd of my flock. And now he's the leader and prophet and deliverer of millions of people. It's like, what has happened? Something incredible has happened. And so Jethro goes to meet with Moses to see him for himself and also to hear the story firsthand. And so in this context, think of Moses primarily as a person who is going to bear witness to what the Lord has done, to bear witness to the salvation of the Lord. It's not going to be by rod, it's not going to be by sword or by plague, but just the word of testimony. Now, verses 7 to 8, as I said, I want to look at first Moses' character and then look at Moses' conversation, because he's a witness and a very effective witness, and we want to look at the kind of character that he has. Notice that Moses doesn't wait for his father-in-law to arrive, but he goes out to meet him, and then he bows down to him, he kisses him, and then he invites him into his tent. So that was the custom. But regardless of custom and culture, you have to admit that Moses, I mean, after all that this man has been through, you know, and now that he's the leader of millions of people and he's the great prophet of Israel, I mean, it's quite something to see him showing this respect and honoring his father-in-law. I tell you, I know personally, I just love it when a person's fame and high position and great wealth don't cause them to become, you know, arrogant towards others. And Moses just seems to have that humility about him. And again, we see that when it says, and they asked each other of their welfare. And again, this speaks volumes to me of Moses' character, right? After everything Moses has gone through, for him to actually take time and ask his father-in-law about his welfare. Amazing. Again, I say this because, you know, so often there are folk that they only care about telling their story and are really not interested in listening to anybody else's story. And, you know, you could really see why Scripture refers to Moses as the meekest or the humblest of men. And it reminded me of something that C.S. Lewis had said. A wonderful insight into humility. He said, don't imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who's always telling you that, of course, he's a nobody. Probably all you will think of him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took real interest in what you had to say. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. And again, this is the picture that we get of Moses, you know, the meekest of all men. And then in verse 8, we get a further insight into Moses' character. And you see it in terms of how he tells his story, how he testifies. Then Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way and how the Lord had delivered them. Again, you notice, you know, in how Moses is telling the story that it's not, this is what I did, or not even, you know, this is what the Lord did through me. It's all about what the Lord did. And how he delivered Moses. And then it says that he began to share about all the hardships that Israel had gone through. And again, it's striking. It's not about his hardships. You know, there's no mention here about Israel persecuting him, as far as we can tell. And that's not the focus of his conversation. It's, these people, how much they have suffered, and yet God delivered them from all their troubles. So again, you know, it's easy to be humble around people that that are more successful than you, that intimidate you and all the rest. But here's Moses humbling himself in the presence of his own family, his father-in-law. It's in a domestic setting, the hardest place sometimes to exercise humility. There's a quote that came to mind: if you're a Christian in small things, you're no small Christian. So again, think of Moses as the meekest of all men, and it's we see this in this context. This conversation was aimed at making God known. He wants Jethro to know God. He wants Jethro to know who God is and what he has done. And so in his telling of the story, he shares about God's power and God's wisdom and mostly about God's salvation. That's why the word deliverance keeps coming up here. And I think it's important for us to take that to heart, that your conversation with people might be the means through which people will come to know Jesus. Faith comes by hearing. You know, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. Go and bear witness. And I really want to emphasize how important spiritual conversations are in bringing people to Christ. They have to hear the story of deliverance and of salvation. I mean, I think it's great to have conversations with people about, you know, moral issues and about political issues and sports and the weather and your day and all the rest. But we need, friends, to really be praying and seeking opportunities to find a way to tell the salvation story. For that story, that gospel, is the story that has power to save. And so, like Moses, I would just encourage people to go and bear witness to the gospel. By the way, I'm just curious, how many of you came to know Christ as a result of conversation? Anybody here? Was it a pastor that preaching from the pulpit? Please, anybody? No. Mostly conversations. Maybe parents having conversations with you or friends having conversations with you. I think you'll find that to be the case. And by the way, you know, I see this in Moses, that he didn't shy away from talking about hardships and in this testimony. And I would say, you know, this is a wonderful way to reveal the power of God and the faithfulness of God in your own life. You know, don't shy away from telling people about the troubles and hardships that you went through and how God came through for you. Because sometimes that's how people can actually see the reality of God in your life. By the way, I mean, when we talk about the gospel, it is about the hardships of Christ and the suffering of Christ and God's deliverance. So, now, in the remainder of the verses, verses 9 to 12, there's a shift. Now we see how Jethro is responding. Now, some of you might be surprised by just the angle that I'm taking here, and you might be asking, like, am I assuming that Jethro is not a believer? And I am inviting you to assume that. It is a disputed question at this point, but it'll make a huge difference which way you think on this issue. I am going to assume that Jethro he's not a true Israelite. He's not a true believer in Yahweh at this point. And as he comes to Moses, he is. He's a pagan worshiper of other gods. And so just assume that he's not saved prior to this conversation. In other words, he was physically related to Moses, but he was not spiritually related. They're not brothers in the Lord, not at this point. And I think what really, you know, convinced me that that's the situation is verse 11, where he says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people." Now I know. So I'm assuming that before this he didn't. Verse 9, so Jethro has been listening to Moses tell his story, and I'm sure it must have been an easy story to listen, you know, the burning bush, and then you know, Israel in slavery, and then meeting with Pharaoh, and then, you know, 10 plagues, and how they crossed the Red Sea. How could you? That would not be a difficult testimony to listen to. Could go on for a long time. Anyways, he's listening to all of this, and we read that he believed that Yahweh had done this for Israel. He believed the story of salvation. For him, it was deemed good news. And notice that this good news didn't just affect, as it were, his thoughts and his beliefs, that he was also deeply moved, because we read he rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel. And so to rejoice suggests that he is taking sides. He's on Israel's side rather than Egypt's side. He's on Israel's side rather than Amalek. And so he chooses Yahweh over the gods of Egypt and Amalek. You know, when we're called to be Christians, we're not called to remain neutral on the issue of what happens to God's people and the worship of other gods. And then in verse 10, we see, again, Jethro, he blesses the Lord. I mean, he is, you know, he rejoices, and now he's giving Yahweh praise. I praise you, God, for what you have done for Moses and for Israel. And it's interesting, because at this point, it's not so much what the Lord has done for him, but what the Lord has done for others in his life. And then we come to verse 11, and verse 11, as I said, I think it's the best verse in this text. It's the confession of a true convert. Now he knows that the God of Israel is the God above all gods. I don't know if you picked up on this, but most of the worship songs that we sang this morning seems to have, you know, that theme. There is none like you. No one else can touch my heart like you do. I could search for all eternity, Lord, and find there is none like you. Chris Tomlin's song, "Our God is greater, our God is stronger. God, you are higher than any other. Our God is healer, awesome in power. Our God, our God." One song that we didn't sing this morning is on the days of Elijah, which has that refrain, "There's no God like Jehovah." Remember that line again, and I mentioned this once before about Pharaoh saying Moses. He said, "Moses is God, is God." That's the sense that we get from this testimony on Jethro's part. And so, because of Moses' conversation, we see him bearing faithful witness to the truth. And now Jethro says, I know God. I know him. Now I see who he is. Oh, what great words of testimony. Can you say those words? Do you know Yahweh? Do you know Jesus? Is he Lord of lords and King of kings and God above all gods? Is he the way, the truth, and the life for you? And again, I mean, not asking whether people simply can pay lip service to that. I'm asking, you know, look at how Jethro responds and how his heart is just boiling over with praise and thanksgiving. And I pray that, you know, the Spirit of God would make that clear to each one of us. I mean, there is no God like Jehovah. He's the greatest. This is how Jesus put it. Because nothing short of knowing this, of knowing God, that he is greater and all the rest, nothing short of that will lead to salvation. I mean, John 17:3, now this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. There's a very interesting follow-up line in verse 11, where Jethro says, they dealt arrogantly with the people. And this is a fascinating line, that Jethro is saying that where you see arrogance is when they reject the revelation of the one true God. That's where you will see the arrogance. They reject him. They prefer their own gods. Arrogance is not making a claim that there is only one true God. I read a quote this week by Woodrow Kroll, and it spoke to me. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev once boasted that he would display the last Soviet Christian on television by 1965. Khrushchev is long dead. Christianity is more alive than ever in Russia. Karl Marx called a belief in God the sign of the oppressed creature, the opium of the people. Marx also has gone to his eternal destiny, but the opium he spoke of continues to spread throughout the world. And so it has been. Leaders rise up. They shake their fists at God and then sink back into oblivion from which they came. And in the meantime, God continues to work out his plan for the world, undisturbed by their puny efforts against him. He doesn't mention this, but I thought of a friend of mine used to have this T-shirt, and it had Friedrich Nietzsche, and underneath it said God is dead, because he was known for that famous phrase. And then underneath that, it has God, Nietzsche is dead. You know, it's got that same idea. Woodrow continues, he said, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, observed the same truth about Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt. Arrogantly, they had shaken their fists at God, but he was above them. Like an ant trying to stop a locomotive, they challenged the Almighty and lost. Once again, God proved that the Lord is greater than all the gods. And throughout history, God has demonstrated that he is greater than any person, any movement, any situation. And if you're fearful about some godless person, some anti-Christian movement, or some threatening situation, remember where your help comes from. The God who is above all other gods will never be overwhelmed by your difficulties. And the God who delivered Moses will deliver you as well. He is just that kind of God. Well said, well put. Friends, as we read this story, it's no small matter, really, when a man gives up the worship of his God or gods and converts over to another god. And he's the priest of Midian. I mean, it will have huge social, political, religious implications as he does that. He must have known that. But now let's look at the final verse, verse 12. It says that Jethro offers a burnt offering and sacrificed it to God. A burnt offering, what's unique about burnt offering is that the whole offering is burnt up, all of it. And it's the complete destruction of the animal. And it's the suggestion here as well is it's the complete surrender of the worshiper to God. Complete surrender. I'm all his. And it also expresses thanksgiving or the fulfillment of a vow. It's almost like he's coming, now that I know that God is is greater than all other gods. Now that I have a clear vision of who he is, I cannot go back to my old way of life. I cannot go back to the old gods and worship them in my old religion. I'm his now, all his, and he is mine. And so I offer myself completely to the Lord from this day forward. In many ways, it's what we want people to be expressing when they get baptized, right? I'm all in, and Jethro is expressing that through the burnt offering. And then we see also in verse 12 one more response. It says, and they ate together what seems to have been a covenant meal, because it says they ate before God, or in the presence of God they ate this meal. So what this meal would do, really, involves worship, but it also brings them together as brothers under Christ or under God. Jethro now is not just a brother-in-law. He's a brother in the Lord. And this meal is going to, you know, express that. He believed and now he eats. And notice he ate bread. There's this discussion that's going on. What kind of bread was it? Was it the manna? Was it the manna that God gave, the heavenly bread, representing Christ himself? For those of you who are here, we are also going to have, we're going to share, partake in the communion meal. And really, you know, it's a time for us to really thank the Lord for his great salvation. It's a time for us to rededicate ourselves to the Lord. And it's also a time for us to look around and say, these are not my brother-in-laws, but they are my brothers and sisters in the Lord. This is my family. I'm gonna share eternity with my family. It's a very rich meal in significance. So just in closing here, so at one level, this story tells the story of a conversion of a family member. And of course, there's always great joy when people in our own families come to know the Lord. But there, at another level, perhaps even at a more deeper level, we are being reminded of who Jethro represents. He is not an Israelite. He's a Midianite, a pagan, a Gentile. And remember, the chapter before, Israel was at war with a nation, with the Amalekites. And then the very next chapter, we read about how Moses is at peace and becomes family with one that belonged to a different nation. And is the Lord... You know, is this chapter here to remind us that the purpose of Israel was not to destroy nations? Yes, some nations would be destroyed because of their rejection of God. But those that would open their hearts, those who God had called unto himself, that there would be a coming together of nations. And so it's a very profound story, a reminder to Israel of their real purpose, going all the way back to the promise that God made to Abraham that Israel would be a blessing to other nations. I am quite certain that this is one of the great lessons that we are to take home with us.